They say everyone has secrets. In fact, a 2017 study from researchers at Columbia University says you probably have 13 of them, five of which you've never told anyone before. And if one person can have so many secrets, how many can one place have? This is In the Hive. I'm Emily Means. Scrolling through Facebook recently, I came across a curious post among the cat memes, recipe videos, and political commentary. It said,
"Tomorrow at my house, I'm doing a presentation on the secret places of Salt Lake City. I'll get things rolling around 8 p.m. I need at least 8 friends to come. Who would like to come?"
That's local performance poet RJ Walker. He needed to put on a presentation for his public speaking class. It seemed fitting for a lecture about secrets to be in a house that looked like it was full of them. The house itself was hidden in plain sight, surrounded by trees on an unassuming corner on 9th East. I initially drove right past it. A full moon lit my way into the yard while a black cat scurried around my legs at the door. The interior of the house had dark wood paneling, the kind haunted houses usually have, though Walker neither confirmed nor denied whether the house was haunted or not. Walker began his presentation by describing three categories of secrets.
So I believe there are three types of secret things. The first type of secret thing is the forgotten thing. It's something old that's been buried, somebody forgot about, somebody left it somewhere, it started to deteriorate, somebody found it, and somebody's preserving it. We find forgotten things all over the place. We find old engravings. We find old carvings. Archaeology is literally the study of forgotten things, of remembering. The second type is the purposely hidden thing. The purposely hidden thing was placed out of sight for some reason or another. It's a secret somebody else didn't want you to know. Maybe it's a secret that keeps somebody safe. Maybe it's a secret that keeps the secret keeper safe. The third type is the thing just discovered. This is my favorite kind because it's when you find something that nobody else seemed to know about. It's a secret that you stumbled upon. It's not something forgotten, it's something new, and you found it.
Walker used Gilgal Garden, the sculpture garden built by Thomas Battersby Child Jr. and featuring a sphinx with Joseph Smith's face, as an example of the forgotten thing.
The name Gilgal, it's called Gilgal, that's what he called it when he made it, refers to the biblical place where Joshua told the Israelites to leave 12 stones as a remembrance. And the big statues in the gardens, the notable statues, like this one here, the dismembered man, there are 12 of them. There are 12 statues in the garden. Everything seems to relate to everything. Everything is loosely connected.
For the purposely hidden thing, Walker highlighted the city's underground tunnel system.
Some theorize that the Mormons built the tunnels. This is kind of a conspiracy theory if you look on the forums, people talk about this. The Mormons built the tunnels in case they had to fight the federal government. The Mormon militia would be very mobile and they'd be able to conceal themselves in the tunnels. There's very little evidence to support this, but I suppose it's a fun story. Mm-hmm. A more realistic theory is that the tunnels are meant to give church officials a mobile and safe way to exist during the apocalypse. The church is the biggest prepper industry that I know of. They believe in food storage, sheltering, all that stuff. And the tunnels go between all the important Mormon buildings.
And for the last category, the thing just discovered, Walker chose a geographical location.
So if you go up past the Capitol, you drive up the hill, keep going, take the third left you see, and you'll go down a street and you'll see an empty lot that looks over the city. I don't know who owns this lot. I could not figure out who owns it or why it's there, if it's part of a neighboring building or if a company owns it or if somebody just bought it. There is a sign that says private property, no trespassing, but looking isn't trespassing. So you can stand like at the edge of where the sign is and look out over the city. You can see State Street right here, like a big glowing artery going all the way down to Draper. From the view, I can point out just about any landmark. I can map out the grid in my head and figure out where things are. You can actually see every single 4th of July fireworks show all at once from up here. You'll see Murray's, Draper's, Sandy's, all the little cities all over the valley, all the way to Magna, all the way to Draper, all the way up to the U. You can see everything all at once from this spot.
After the presentation, I asked Walker why he was so interested in this city's secrets.
I've always been really fascinated with ghost stories and urban legends. I've always felt very connected to them. There's a certain relationship that human beings have with place, with being in a place. And Salt Lake is a very different city than a lot of cities. It's kind of like in Neil Gaiman's book, Neverwhere. There's London above, and then there's London below, where all the disenfranchised people and things go. And that's why nobody in London sees homeless people, because they exist on this in this other dimension, London below. Salt Lake is kind of like that. There's like pure white Mormon Salt Lake, and then there's everybody else below. All the bars that have to be underground, all the things that have to be secret. The interesting history and lore of the city is buried so that it looks like a bright and shiny Zion. But the real culture of the city lies beneath the surface. You have to look. Anybody who tells you Salt Lake City is boring just is too lazy to look.
You listed three secrets. Gilgal Gardens, which is a bizarre place in Salt Lake City, in basically like suburban Salt Lake City, just in a neighborhood. You listed the tunnels underneath the city and then the view, right? That's what it's called. How did you find these secrets?
The Gilgal Gardens, I heard about from an old man in a coffee shop, an old man at coffee break. Was talking about how there's a sphinx with Joseph Smith's face. And I thought he was crazy. And then I Googled it. And I was like, holy crap, this is real. There's an organization called Friends of Gilgal Gardens whose goal it is to preserve this very special statue garden. And it's just in a backyard. When I first tried to look for it, I Googled it and there was an address. And I went there, but I was like, where is it? So I just started walking around and looking at the houses, and then I saw a sign that said Gilgal Sculpture Garden Park. And I just kept walking, and I was in a backyard, and that's where this interesting place was. The tunnels beneath the city, when I was Mormon, I did get to explore a bit of the tunnels. Most Mormons who are doing baptisms or are going to weddings end up in the tunnels, and they might not even know it. But I did. I realized I was in some sort of underground tunnel network, and I wanted to know more about it. And then I started going to places like The Rest, the Off-Broadway Theater, Quarters. They're all connected. Eborn Books is also connected to this tunnel network. Main Street sits on a large tunnel, and a series of tunnels and branches. And so I started exploring and digging. Why were there these tunnels? Why make them? I heard all the ghost stories. There was one forum that said that if you're in The Rest and you sit in a certain chair and you look out of the corner of your eye into a mirror, you'll see a Mormon soldier maintaining some weapons or cleaning his weapons in case he had to fight the federal government. And these are all rumors, but I wanted to see what was real and what was just an exciting story.
And then the view, of course, you said that your dad shared with you.
Yeah, my dad shared it with me, and I've taken lots of friends up there. I mean, it's free. There's not a lot to do anymore these days. There's this big family fun industry in Salt Lake above with bowling alleys and trampoline parks and stuff. But the Salt Lake below things to do take a little more work, but usually they're free. You can just go to the view. And you can look out over the city, and you can point, and you can say, that's where my house is.
What do you think makes a good secret?
There are secrets of the mouth, which are secrets that you discover and you can't wait to tell somebody.
the secrets you want to share, the secrets that are almost not secrets on purpose. Like when people come to my open mic, like everybody's like, oh, is this a secret open mic? I'm like, all our open mics are secret open mics. We don't try to keep it a secret. It's just we don't advertise. But then there are secrets of the heart. And those are bad secrets. Those are the secrets that rot you away. That's where guilt lives. These are secrets that are where you would refuse to admit that you did something wrong to anyone. And you just hold this toxic peace. That's a bad secret.
Should we share those secrets that weigh on us so heavily?
Maybe, if it helps. A lot of my poetry is the expression of those secrets of the heart. It's admitting where I failed. And it's admitting the times where there wasn't a right answer and making the hard conversation exist.
Kind of going off of this this point that we just made, should people share secrets? And I guess it's dependent on what kind of secret it is. Or does the sharing of the secret make it lose its luster?
I don't necessarily know if sharing the secret makes it not as fun anymore. It does depend, you know. Sometimes it's better to hear the beautiful story than the boring or awful truth. And stories are great. There's an emotional truth, at least in every story, or a philosophical truth. But I think it is important to know what those truths are and know the difference between an emotional truth and an objective truth. My poetry is, I mean, obviously, I'm not an old man, but when I do my grandpa millennial poem, I take the persona of an old man to tell the emotional truth of, like, I have depression, and I hope that I survive to be an old man. This is what I look like if I survive. And that's the secret that is most worth sharing.
RJ Walker picked a good selection of secrets, but acknowledged there were even more to talk about.
There's all kinds of bizarre, weird secret places in the city that I didn't get to cover. Oh, and things about the Salt Lake City Library. That place hides a lot of secrets, too, if you explore it deep enough.
He was right. The city library is full of secrets. And librarian Cherry Willis shared a few from the collection.
I'm looking for secrets that belong to this place. And, you know, we're here in the heart of downtown, but it could be secrets you know about Utah as well. So what's your best secret?
Oh, wow. I have so many. There's so many that are all there in my head. I think right now, because we're working with this exhibit on what we call Future Vision, it's urban planning. Come on over and I'll show you some of these things. And again, because I've born and raised in Salt Lake and my traditions go way back to 1849, 47 actually. Salt Lake sometimes gets a lot of ribbing because we seem provincial, we seem a little backward. Actually, there are so many things about Salt Lake that we have always been on the forefront. And the first of that actually is our plan. It is based on the City of Zion plan that Joseph Smith himself drew up in 1833. And over the years, more and more civic planners, urban designers, have come to appreciate how extraordinary that plan was, so that when the pioneers showed up here in 1847, they knew exactly how to lay out their city. They knew how to establish working relationships with each other, and the plan has proven to be exceptional over time. This is one of my favorite books that we have here, which is just a book on urban planning that says, you know, the Salt Lake plan, it was the best. I just love that. This plan right here then shows you how this became Lake City. So here's my best secret. I own the library. Because my great-great-grandfather, who came with Brigham Young in the original 1847 July 24th caravan, everybody that came was given a plot here in Salt Lake, and then was given a 5-acre or larger, depending on their family, plot out where, which is now called Sugar House. They call the 5-acre sea with 5-acre survey. But here, everybody was given a plot to live in town. These are the plots. And right here is Washington Square. And right there, that little corner that says Addison Everett, that was my great-great-grandfather. We are standing on his plot.
Well, I think maybe we should rename the library. It just seems fair.
It seems fair. But when I found that out, I thought, this is amazing. This is his plot. And what a great thing for him to have the library build on his plot, because I know he would have appreciated that. So some other great things and cool about Salt Lake is we were one of the first 5 cities to have a central electricity. That's, you know, again, after London and New York, San Francisco, and, interestingly enough, Cleveland, you know, Salt Lake had electricity, which was amazing. So this is a really early engineering map that shows all of where we were putting the electric streetlights. We have these great engineering plans, which are really fun to look for. If they're over, you know, 120 years old, some of them, that show before and after. We were paving streets in Salt Lake before there were automobiles. So we are always urban planning, always forward thinking.
So I have a question for you. Yeah. Are you the curator of the special collections?
Technically, we don't have one specifically. We all work in it. I kind of shepherd a lot of it. I'm kind of like team leader over our team that works with special collections.
Okay, so obviously there are so many books and things housed at the library. I imagine a lot of secrets within that massive collection. How do you go about finding them?
You just spend time with it. Fortunately, most all of this is cataloged, but we do have some that's not. And so I spend a lot of my time researching things using the State History website, using Mountain West Digital Library, which is the most phenomenal pictorial resource that anyone can use because it's free, and it is the digitized images from all over the Mountain West. It's just fabulous. I can show you some of those. These I got from the Mountain West Digital Library. That shows at one time a desire they were going to actually tear down the city and county building.
And it's historic.
I know. This was the 60s. This was brutalist architecture, and they were going to rebuild, and this whole plot here, brand new, you know, kind of gives that real Soviet era look to it, and tear down everything, and it was going to be the city and county building, the jail, and the public safety center, all there. I'm so glad that didn't happen.
But our city has character still.
It does. But that image, fortunately, was preserved. These things are really, I love this. In the early 60s, the American Institute for Architects got together with the city to devise what they called the second century plan. And so much of our city planning, even today, goes back to this plan. One of them is that we would have a covered farmer's market. And, you know,
maybe someday.
And, you know, that's actually now in the goals for Downtown Rising, which is from the Downtown Alliance. That's still within the 1 to 3 years we're going to get that. But this is like my favorite little secret here with this. They were going to have a porpoise pond.
With proper dolphins?
You know, it's true. Because really seriously, that's a dolphin. That's not a porpoise. You're right. But yeah, so there's Penny's, there's Woolworths, there's Zions Bank, there's Grants for people who remember those stores. And they're going to have this lovely, you know, mammal aquatic. I just love that. It didn't happen.
Maybe someday. It's in the 20-year plan.
Hopefully. Right now, that's actually where the ice rink is for the Gallivan Center. So is that kind of that maybe a little water feature. Okay. The other thing I love is one time they were thinking of a monorail. Mm. Wouldn't that have been cool?
I mean, I do love our track system. I get around that way very easily, but, you know, this is kind of futuristic,
like
shiny
Disneyland.
New.
Yeah, see, let me, this right here. They had people movers designed to go from the Union Pacific train station and the Rio Grande train station all the way from the stations to downtown Salt Lake. And they had these lovely little canopies that were to actually evoke the Conestoga wagon look of our pioneer settlers. And you could just get right on those and just travel from your train right down into Salt Lake, never having to walk.
If someone is looking for a secret, like they have one in mind, what's the best way for them to go about finding it at the library here?
Certainly talk to us. They certainly can go online. Like I say, most of this is cataloged in our catalog. You can look stuff up. But certainly talk to us, because those of us that have worked with this collection, we kind of have a feel for where some of the things are. And like I say, every few months we do one of these exhibits. We've done music, we've done architecture, we've done lost things. One of the things we lost, people love the tunnels under the ground. We also had restrooms underground. They were called comfort stations. and they were just charming at the turn of the last century. So we have a couple engineering pictures of those that were just, that made Salt Lake a very comforting and warming place. It was fun. Cool. And sometime we'll talk about the whales for the Salt Lake.
You can check out the Future Visions exhibit in the Special Collections section of the main library through November 17th. For some people, looking for secrets isn't just about satisfying your curiosity. It's about doing a job.
I say mostly secrets in journalism are things that you stumble onto or things that you find by peeling back the layer of something. Say like you read something in a court document and then you start sort of twisting that around in your brain to figure out why it's kind of nagging at you. And it's in the digging and the twisting and the unraveling that you find things you weren't expecting.
Jennifer Dobner is a veteran reporter in Utah. She's covered a variety of beats, including courts, politics, and religion, and has worked for local media at the Deseret News, Associated Press, and the Salt Lake Tribune. As an investigative journalist, she's good at finding secrets. I asked her to explain her process for looking for them.
Okay, it happens in lots of different ways. It's not a straight line. So sometimes you're at an assignment, and maybe it's even something as simple as a press conference, and so the issue of the moment is, I don't know, the cost of garbage pickup. But somebody will say something kind of as an afterthought or offhand that it may not fit in the story that day, but it kind of nags at me. And then I think I should go back and ask more questions about that. Or I should ask for the data on that. Or I should clarify, what did that person mean, really? Because sometimes people say things in a way that is like messaging to the wider public or a wider audience that just, I don't know, it just sort of sticks with you and you have to go looking. Sometimes it happens in when you're reading documents. A document will make a reference to something or a person, and then you have to go, or I always have to go, and like look at the next piece of that or find the report or the document or the person from which that fact originated so I can understand it even more or more clearly. Sometimes that is like going down a rabbit hole that takes you nowhere. But a lot of times it leads you to things you don't expect.
Well, it sounds like a really time-consuming process. You know, is anything ever just like hidden in plain sight?
I think a lot of times things are hidden in plain sight. I can think of an example. Terry Deal, who is a longtime developer in Utah and who spent a lot of time on the UTA board. I spent some time covering him during 2017. And he was indicted by the federal government in a bankruptcy case in the spring of, in April 2017. And in the bankruptcy filing, there was this list of, not really names, they were like names of companies and initials of people whom the government said had paid Mr. Deal some money at the time that he claimed that he was bankrupt. They were like, you filed the bankruptcy in April, then in May and June, all this money came into you. And was it properly reported in your bankruptcy case?
Mm-hmm.
So I was curious about that. I mean, I wrote the story on the day that the indictment was issued and I cranked out the facts. But then a couple weeks later, I went back to those documents and I started looking at the initials and the names of the companies. And then I started asking questions of myself, like, well, who are these people? And whose company is that? And then you start the digging. And so that to me was like a secret that was in plain sight, because if the name of the company X is there, but it doesn't tell you who owns it, well, then you can go to the Department of Commerce and look at the business registrations and the company filing information, and you can find out, oh, guess what? That company is owned by the Speaker of the House. Or that company is owned by developer Y and developer C, who also had received big contracts from UTA when Mr. Deal was either on the board or recently after he left the board. And so that raised all kinds of questions for me and for my reporting partner, Tom Harvey, about was there a trail of impropriety or some sort of corruption there? And that's how it happens in journalism, mostly, I think.
A lot of asking questions, a lot of digging through like document after document after document, a lot of calling people and building relationships.
Yeah, that's the other way that you get things sometimes, or you stumble onto secrets. A few years back when I was at the AP, there was a big debate raging in the Utah legislature over the Legacy Parkway. And some of the meetings were held, you know, in secret, not in secret, but closed to reporters and the public so lawmakers could more freely discuss certain aspects of things. But somebody I knew who had been involved in those meetings or was close to those meetings actually was able to say to me, here's the core issue that no one's talking about, you know, and I can't say who it was. But when that person said, like, the bottom line issue is they're having a big fight over when is a truck a truck, like how many axles make a truck. And
it seems like a small thing.
It seems like a small thing, but I understand, like I understood the intellectual point of that. But, and of course that person said to me, you know, you can't tell anyone that I told you, which of course I never would do, but it informed me in a way that I was able to go to the key people in those discussions and say, hey, so can you tell me anything more about this? What's really going on? And when, as they started to explain, like in broad terms, like we're talking about what types of traffic would be allowed and at what capacity. And I'm like, so are you saying, like, when is a truck a truck? Like, how many axles makes a truck? And he said, well, exactly. And then we were able to publish that story. And I can remember one of the posted comments about it was that our reporting was so prescient, you know, and insightful because we figured it out. Mm-hmm. And we did figure it out, but not without help. And so sometimes, yeah, it's relationships. It's doing good work over time that you've developed a reputation, that people in the community bring you things because they trust you or they know someone who trusts you. I've had people say that to me before. I asked so-and-so about you and they say you're okay, so I will talk to you. And it's hours and hours of document diving and, you know, time you can't get back in your life.
So the last part of the process, I imagine, is confirming that the secret is true. Mm-hmm. Do we ever actually know if it is?
Well, I would say that after 25 years of doing this, I think the truth is always somewhere in the middle, and that the secrets or the things that you uncover, you're going to get close. I mean, people don't object to you printing things unless you're close to the truth, and often people do object to that. But also, people tell you their version of what they believe to be true. And in the absence of hard data, figures, you know, statistical averages, whatever it would be, that's all you're going to get is somebody's version of what they believe is true. So their view of the secret and your view of the secret might be slightly different things, but we do our best to print the most accurate, you know, and tell the most accurate story that we can tell.
Do you have any big secret that you're willing to share with us or that you're going to be diving into soon?
Not things that I can say without violating confidence.
Oh, it's a secret?
And this is the challenge. Like sometimes that's like eating you up. You're dying to tell someone. And you even keep it from, you know, I've kept things from editors until I like knew for sure or felt like I had stuff I could actually act on and write on, because I take those being trusted with information, I take that really seriously, every journalist I know takes those things seriously. And that's also how you build a good reputation, by not violating those confidences. But yeah, there's a lot of interesting things to discover out there.
What's the best secret you know about the place you live? Weigh in at KCPW's Facebook page, KCPW 88.3, or email us at comments@kcpw.org with your feedback and questions. Special thanks to In the Hive intern Sarah Sadikon and the rest of the KCPW team for their support of this show, as well as to Andrew Shaw, who produced the show's theme music. And thank you for tuning in. You can find podcasts of In the Hive at kcpw.org. Up next is Both Sides of the Aisle. I'm Emily Means. Thanks for listening.